Thank you everyone for coming. Today we'll have Ruben Essig, Professor Ruben Essig from Stony Brook. Ruben did his PhD at Rutgers University and then did a postdoc at Stanford. Is that right?
Slack.
Oh, at Slack.
Okay.
And he has done a lot of work on dark matter, and today in particular he'll tell us about a new type of detection schemes.
Okay. So thank you very much. I've had many opportunities sort of to visit here, but I've never actually been able to come for not, unfortunately. But so I'm very happy to be here. So I'm going to talk about the direct detection of sub-GV dark matter. And this is work with Jeremy Marden, who's a postdoc now at Stanford, and Tomo Volansky, who most of you probably know. He's a faculty in Tel Aviv. That's part of the work, and then also talking my work with Jeremy and Toma and two experimentalists on Xenon 10, Ehrman Alese and Peter Sorensen. And the basic idea of the talk is that people don't usually consider direct detection of dark matter for dark matter masses less than a GeV. The usual attitude is that it's impossible. I'll show you that it's not impossible, the idea is very simple, and I'll present some first limits and also some future prospects for this. So the basic answer to the question implicit in the thing is that it is possible. So there's lots of evidence for dark matter. We're still trying to figure out what exactly it is. Perhaps the evidence is best exemplified by this picture of the Buddha cluster, which consists of two huge galaxy clusters that collided and went past each other. And there's a clear offset where most of the baryonic matter is in this red part, and where most of the dark matter or invisible matter is in this blue part, which suggests that there's some additional matter there that we just don't know what exactly it is. So the question is, what is dark matter? That's one of the most important questions that we have at the moment, and we're trying to answer it, given that 80% of the matter density in the universe is consists of this dark matter particle. And there's a major experimental effort that's underway, and I think there's a real chance of success of trying to of detecting the actual dark matter particle in the coming years. There's lots of different experiments that are involved that are looking for it, and we're probing the relevant parameter space for many, many models. But the question that I want to ask is, are we really looking everywhere we can and where we should be looking? And I think the answer is no. In fact, most of the searches for dark matter particles focus on the so-called weakly interacting massive particles, or WIMPs. So these are particles like the neutralina and the supersymmetric standard model with masses between about a GeV and 1,000 GeV. And there are many good reasons why the focus is on WIMPs, and I'll tell you some of them in a minute. But the question is, what if dark matter is lighter than this? What if it's less than a GeV? What if it's not a WIMP? And how do we detect that? Okay. So why are WIMPs great? So it's always good to remind oneself why WIMPs are great. One reason is that there's this so-called WIMP miracle, where you can naturally obtain the correct abundance from thermal freeze-out. So you just calculate in the early universe, you assume that the dark matter is in thermal equilibrium with ordinary matter, with the standard model matter. You calculate, and what you find is that the dark matter abundance is about 0.1, so omega H2 is about 0.1, that's what's observed, times 3 times 10 minus 26 centimeters cubed per second over the cross-section times velocity. Okay, so for a sigma V of this order of magnitude, you get the right thermogradient abundance. Now, why is that interesting? The reason it's interesting is because if you ask what typical cross-section times velocities you can get in just with typical dark matter particles, we find that this sigma v is about the right order of magnitude if you take a weak scale coupling, so weak scale, like alpha weak, and a dark matter mass that's of order the weak scale, 100 GeV. Now that's very intriguing because we know of many models that where we try to solve the hierarchy problem, where there's particles there that can in principle be stable, and they come along for free in many attempts to explain the Higgs hierarchy problem, and they have this order of magnitude, sigma v of order this cross-section, which happens to be 3 times 10 to minus 26. So that's why WIMPs are great, because they sort of come along very naturally in many models. And the other reason they have so much focus, I think a reason that's equally important, is that they're very testable. So if you want a scientific theory that you can test, this is really a very nice scientific model that you can test, because you can try to detect them with indirect detection, where you look for dark matter particles annihilating in the galactic halo or decaying in the galactic halo. You look for particles. You can look for the dark matter particle at colliders, so at the LHC. And you can also look for dark matter particles at direct detection experiments. And direct detection experiments will be the focus of this talk. Okay. So we'll focus on direct detection. And the basic idea of the direct detection is the following, that you've got some dark matter particle in our halo, so in our Milky Way halo. And as the Earth goes around the sun, and as we are going through this Milky Way halo, we can have dark matter particles that can interact with ordinary matter, so standard model matter, scatter off it, and the standard model particle can recoil off this. So that's the basic idea of direct detection. And how does this work in slightly more detail and with a little cartoon picture? The basic thing is that you take a detector with lots and lots of nuclei. And these nuclei could be germanium, could be xenon, argon, sodium iodine, people have used all kinds of things. And then you wait until there's a dark matter particle that's in the halo that hits a nucleus and recoils a nucleus, gives you a recoiling nucleus. And then what you can do is you try to detect this recoiling nucleus through a variety of mechanisms. Exactly what you use depends on the material that you have. So, but the typical signals that people look for are phonons. For example, in germanium, you can produce phonons. You can use, they also look for scintillation light, or they can look for ionization signals. Okay, so those are sort of the three typical signals that people are looking for. So that's a very simple mechanism. Now, the current situation of direct detection is very confusing, I think. There are many different experiments that are looking for it. So here's a quick snapshot. So this is a typical plot that people always show in this business. So on the horizontal axis is the mass scale of the dark matter particle. Okay, it's usually labeled as the WIMP mass between a GeV and a TeV here. So these are really focusing on weak scale masses also. On the vertical axis, you have the cross section to scatter off the nucleon. Okay, just tells you the strength of the interaction. And then people plot various things on here. So one thing, I'll plot a few things for you on this. So there's a region, well, there's an experiment called Dharma Libra, which sees the signal for more than 10 years now. They don't know what it is, but it's consistent with dark matter. There is another experiment called Cogent, which sees a signal, which looks more and more that it's just some background. But if you take the signal as coming from dark matter, the rough region that you might want to lie in this cross-section mass plane is about here. So this is the few regions for Dharma that you get. Then there's lots of other experiments that don't see anything that are set constraints. So Xenon 100 probably has the best constraint at higher masses currently. So this is this black line. So everything above you is ruled out. There's Xenon 10, which through an interesting analysis, which I'll get to later, is able to constrain masses that go slightly lighter in mass, so down to 8, 7 GeV or so. There's CREST 1, which is actually run from 2001, I think, which doesn't do very well at high masses, but at low masses, it gives you the best constraints. So below a few GeV, it gives the best, one of the best constraints. Yeah, I think it's sapphire. So it's aluminum and something else.
I think that's what's written there.
Oh, sorry. Oh, that's, yeah, thanks. Yeah,
that was the title. Yeah.
That's right. Yeah. So the new crest is this. The old one is sapphire. It's a lighter element. Absolutely. Thanks. There's also a recent thing from DAMIC, which uses CCDs, sort of a very interesting thing, which is able to probe even lighter. And that's the best limit that I know about for sort of these low masses, few GeV in range. There's many more experiments that I'm not listing. There's really a huge community, and they're basically all looking for WIMPs. Okay, they've been optimized to look for WIMPs. Now, why have they been optimized to look for WIMPs? So what's sort of the typical energy scales that are involved? So let's just quickly go through some simple calculation here. So the relevant quantity really is the nuclear recoil energy. And if you just ask what that is, the order of that is about half mu v squared, where mu is the reduced WIMP nucleus mass, so the reduced mass of the WIMP nucleus system. There's a velocity here, which is the dark matter velocity, which is of order 10 to the minus 3 times the speed of light, so order a few hundred kilometers per second in our halo. And if you put in some typical numbers, so mu by 50 GeV, velocity 10 to minus 3, as I said, you get about 25 kV. So these, you know, order tens of kV. That's what these experiments were designed to detect. And that's sort of easy, in quotation marks, to detect for these experiments. That's what they're designed to do. But the question I want to ask is, what if it's not this heavy dark matter particle? What if it's not a WIMP? Okay? What if dark matter really is much lighter? And the first question is, you know, why is it okay to pick on WIMPs? WIMPs are so great, and they are great. I think people should keep looking for them. But why is it okay to pick on them? There are many reasons. Well, first of all, we haven't seen them despite years of searching. Okay, so we really should be, I think, looking for all kinds of candidates, not just the ones that are easy, in quotation marks, to find, or that are motivated from obvious theoretical things. There are other candidates that are also motivated. So that's the second point here. So many new physics models have dark matter particles that are non-WIMPs. There are other, they also have a stable particle. They're dark matter, they could be dark matter, but they are just not WIMPs, okay? There are many other ways to get the correct dark matter relic abundance. It's not just from thermal freeze out. So, you know, thermal freeze out is a very nice way to get it, but there are many other ways to get it. So we should really not just focus on that single thing. And then there's still no new physics at that HC, which, you know, could maybe solve the hierarchy problem and might have some other dark matter particle floating around. So, you know, all these reasons, I think, makes it okay to pick on WIMPs, and we should sort of try and expand our horizon a little bit. And this statement is more, not so much aimed at this audience, but in general, you know, one shouldn't just let a paradigm, like the WIMP paradigm, blind oneself to other experimental opportunities. Okay. So instead of considering only this, the usual plot that people make, I think we really should be considering a much wider plot and ask, what if dark matter lives in this region down here, you know, MeV up to GeV? And the question is, how do we detect that? Okay. So the outline of the talk will be the following. So I'm going to, as I said, focus on direct detection of light dark matter. I'll first mention some constraints that worries that people might have about light dark matter. You know, is it really allowed? Why don't we usually talk about it? What are the constraints? Then focus on the direct detection, and then end with some future things, where the thing might go. Okay, so let's start with the constraints. First question first. Is sub-GeV dark matter even allowed? No? There must be constraints on it, and there are, but we'll see that it's okay. So one, there's several possible constraints. I'll just mention a few of them. One of them comes from free streaming. So the lighter the dark matter, the easier it is to wash out small scale structure. It just can't form small scale structure. And in particular, there are constraints from observations of small scale structure like dwarf galaxies and also Lyman alpha forest constraints, which set constraints on the dark matter mass. But in general, there's no constraint for dark matter masses above a few keV. So if we're interested in MeV to GeV range, you know, we're fine. So free streaming is not really an issue. Another interesting constraint comes actually from the cosmic microwave background. So this is the idea that if dark matter is annihilating, okay, dark matter can annihilate early in the universe, it could produce charged particles or particles that interact electromagnetically. These particles could interact with the cosmic microwave background photons. They could scatter the cosmic microwave background photons. So dark matter annihilation would produce these charged particles that could scatter the cosmic microwave background photons, which would distort the cosmic microwave background that we see. So there are constraints on that. And the constraints are on this plot. So, well, the axes aren't very clear. So on the vertical axis, the annihilation cross-section for dark matter, so sigma times V. And on the horizontal axis, the dark matter mass. And, sorry, this is not clear. This is 10 GeV, this is 100 GeV, 1,000 GeV. And the WIMP cross-section, so the 3 times 10 to minus 26 is this line here. And what you notice is that everything blue is ruled out. This Planck forecast, that's what Planck should be able to probe. And this thing here is cosmic variance limit. That's cosmic variance limit. So that's sort of the best kind of limit that you could get in principle from the CMB. But what you notice is that cross-sections less than about 10 GeV or so are ruled out for standard freeze-out. So a WIMP cross-section of 3 times 10 to minus 26 is disfavored just from the CMB alone, roughly below 10 GeV or so. There are other limits when dark matter annihilates. So if dark matter is annihilating to charged stuff, for example, to W plus W minus or mu plus U minus or BB bar, people have looked at nearby dwarf galaxies, which are clumps of dark matter halos in our own big Milky Way halo. So these are smaller clumps. And by looking at dwarf galaxies, they were able to set constraints on the annihilation cross-section for dark matter for various channels. Various of them are shown here to BB bar, tau plus tau minus, and so on. And there's, again, the 3 times 10 to minus 26 line. And again, below, you know, 10, 20 GeV or so, you start disfavoring the WIMP cross-section for some of the channels. But basically, the constraints are model-dependent, and they can be avoided. One simple thing is that don't let the dark matter particle annihilate, or let it annihilate only with a smaller cross-section.
Oh, so you don't want thermal?
So I wouldn't have thermal WIMPs. That's what I'm saying. These are non-WIMPs. So sub-GeV dark matter would be non-WIMPs, just because of the constraints.
But it can also annihilate into neutrinos, for example.
Right. It could do that too, right? Yeah. So you can build models. So you don't want them to annihilate to something that can affect the CMB or produce photons that you can detect. So they're model dependent, right? And you have to avoid those. I mean, you have to worry about these constraints, but they can be avoided. And some examples are, for example, light asymmetric dark matter. So dark matter doesn't have an antiparticle with which it can annihilate, and it's just stable. It doesn't annihilate. You can imagine having freeze-out within a hidden sector, so-called WIMPless dark matter also, where you've got freeze-out, but you're not freezing out with the standard model, ordinary matter sector, but with some hidden sector. And then there's also an idea called freeze-in. I'm just sort of throwing these out there. This is not a talk about models, but there are ways to avoid these.
But how does freeze-out within a hidden sector help you, really? I mean, you end up dumping all this energy at some point to...
But you're not producing charged stuff. And you might have some hidden sector that has light particles, and
oh,
they just don't see them.
You're staying in the hidden sector.
Right.
So it's like neutrinos.
Yeah, that's right.
So you're looking at candidates that are not equilibrium.
I'm looking. I would be interested in candidates that don't have the normal standard freeze out, like a WIMP would have. So non-WIMP. Yeah. So that's something you would have to worry about. But again, it's not. Yeah, it's something that you have to worry about, but you can avoid it. Yeah. Okay. Finally, another point is that dark matter, if it has interactions, it could have self-interactions. There are constraints on the dark matter self-interaction cross-section.
Why is linear constraint relevant? I mean, it's talking about MFB to GeV dark matter. But when you said sub, I didn't know how sub it meant.
It depends. So, I mean, yeah, so for MFB, it's okay. But
let's say you have a massive hidden photon.
So you would have constraints on the hidden photon.
Yeah, you can
which
the,
is again model dependent.
The effective temperature there is small.
Right. So there are constraints on any particular model, but there's nothing, you know, that again that just rules out sub-GeV dark matter in general. That's sort of the point I wanna make. So there's these self-interaction constraints where dark matter self-interactions could distort halo shapes. They could distort, you know, there's a constraint on the Bode cluster, because there it looks like the dark matter is pretty collisionless. So if you want to put a constraint on the self-adash cross-section of dark matter, you get some constraint, you have to worry about it. And as I mentioned already, halo shapes. Again, things that you have to worry about, but there are model-dependent things you have to worry about, and you can avoid them. Okay, and that's the last point down here. So in general, the answer to the question, is sub-GeV dark matter allowed? The answer is yes. You just have to be aware of the constraints. In any particular model, you have to worry about them. But in general, you can take care of that.
So these constraints and Bode clusters were at least now constraints on the self-interaction?
On the self-interaction. So if you imagine the dark matter interacts with itself, it can, you know, transfer energy. It's not just some collisionless particle.
Do you happen to know what's the number of the medium it's
the halo is roughly...
For a GeV particle. I think it's for a GeV particle, it's like 10 to minus 24. I always forget.
So it's a bond.
It's a bond? Right, yeah.
10
to minus 24. So it's pretty large, right? It's a huge cross section. But there are models where you have to worry about it, and especially if the dark matter mass is very low, right, then these constraints become also stronger. So that's so the, these constraints become worse, or you have to worry about them more for light and dark matter particles. Okay, so that's the basic thing. Okay, so let's talk about direct detection now, and let's see how we can actually detect them. So again, elastic nuclear recoils that people usually look for, the standard way of looking in these, doing these experiments, don't work. So for heavy dark matter particles, they work fine because you've got a nucleus that you hit and there's a large recoil which you can detect. For light dark matter particles, they don't work very well. So you've got this little tiny little dark matter particle that comes in, hits a nucleus, and barely makes any dent. And you just can't see the recoiling nucleus because it doesn't deposit enough energy that you can see. Okay. Now, let's just go back to do a simple estimate. So there is elastic nuclear recoils. The energy of the recoiling nucleus is given by q squared over 2mn, where q is the momentum transfer. And that's of order the dark matter mass times the velocity, especially for very light dark matter particles. And if you put in some typical numbers, what you find is that for a dark matter mass of about 100 MeV, so that's sort of in the range that we're interested in, a nucleus mass of 10 GeV, and the velocity of the dark matter particle of 10 to the minus 3, or 300 kilometers per second, you get an energy for the recoiling nucleus of about an EV. Not very much. And that's basically way too small to excite or ionize anything that, that you can actually detect in the detector. And this is why, for very light dark matter particles, you just can't see the recoiling nucleus very well. But if you ask how much, oh yeah, and that's also the reason why all these bounds that you see, they always go up at a few GeV, just because here you just don't have enough energy to see anything. But if you ask how much energy is actually available, okay, how much energy is available? Well, it's the dark matter mass, kinetic energy of the dark matter particle in the halo, which is a half dark matter mass times v squared. And that's for the same numbers, so 100 MeV dark matter particle and a velocity of 300 kilometers per second, is about 50 EV, which is much larger than this one EV. So for the same kind of dark matter particle, you have a lot of energy that's really available. It's just that it doesn't get dumped very well into the nucleus recoil. Yeah, okay, so just put in MeV. I'll show you. So this is much larger, okay? And you also notice that it scales differently. This is linear with the mass. This is squared with the mass squared. And this is enough energy to excite or ionize an atom or dissociate molecules, potentially. And this is how you potentially see it. So I'll talk about three different ways to try and detect sub-GeV dark matter: ionization, excitation, and molecular dissociation. These are speculation, okay? I'll just mention them. But I'm not going to focus on them. I'll focus on ionization, because I have much more to say about that. Let me quickly start with ionization. What's the simple idea? So here's our favorite picture again. You've got the atom. Now I add an electron around it. Here's my little dark matter particle. And now what I want to do is I want to scatter it off the electron, and I want to just ionize the atom. And my signal would be, not instead of trying to detect the nucleus and the effect that you get from the nucleus, I'm just going to try and detect the single electron. And I might, well, I'll get a single electron event, or maybe this electron, if it has enough energy, could ionize other things, so I might get a few electron events. Okay, that's the basic signal. The threshold for this is about an EV to 100 EV, depending on the material. And the amazing thing is that, or the surprising thing, at least for me, was that existing technologies can measure ionization even of a single electron. Okay, and I'll show you one. I'll talk about one today. Okay. And this will be the focus of today, as I said. Very briefly, another potential idea that could work, but just needs more thought, is that instead of ionizing the atom, I'm going to scatter the electron, just excite it to an excited state. Then it de-excites and releases a photon. And your signal, instead of an electron, would just be this de-excitation photon that you could, in principle, look for. Of course, there's background. So the threshold, sorry, for this is about the same, of course, as the ionization, or even a little bit less. But currently, at least, the single photon detection is too noisy of anything that I know about. And this would require more work, also on the experimental side, to determine if this is feasible or not. But at least it's an idea that excitations or so might be able to work. Third thing, again, a bit speculative, is molecular dissociation. So instead of taking atoms, let's take molecules. And molecules several of them have binding energy of just a few eV, so not very much at all. And the idea would be that you scatter the nucleus, one of the nuclei, and you break apart the molecules, you create ions, and if you can try to detect the ions some way, maybe apply an electric field, maybe you're able to drift them, and then maybe you'll be able to detect them. So again, this is just throwing it out there, and it requires a lot more work and a lot more thought to see if it's actually feasible. But that's one way you could test nuclear interactions. Okay. So as I mentioned in this talk, we'll focus on the ionization signal. And I want to show you a proof of principle for the ionization signal, which is the work that we did with two experimentalists. So the work that Jeremy and Thomas and I did with two experimentalists on xenon 10. It hasn't appeared in the archive yet. It's still going through the review process. But I'll try and show you the first direct detection limits on dark matter masses down to a few MeV. In mass.
Maybe you'll get to that, but electron volt is like 10 to the minus 4 Kelvin. So you need a, I would think we need a pretty cold detector. Or your thermal noise is not about.
So if your ionization is that low, yeah, you would have to worry about it. So you would have want a cold detector, yes. For the xenon stuff, it's not an issue.
Why?
Because ionization is, well, I'll tell you, it's 12 eV. That's the lowest energy. So you're worried about just thermal excitation or ionizing thermal, ionizing the xenon atom just from thermal energy? So. I don't think that's
that's possible. I mean, I know that best, for example, is a millikelvin, tens of millikelvin.
Yeah, I don't know the temperature of shear xenon. They never talk about it, so I don't know actually. But I don't think they talk about it.
I mean, it's like that. It's
different,
like,
right? Because there it's nuclear recoil.
I don't know.
What?
You know what they do
for
xenon?
For xenon, I don't know. But for xenon, it's not.
I think it's tiny, yeah.
It's quarters of magnitude.
But as I'm saying, if you care for nuclear events, it doesn't matter. But if you care for electronic events,
temperature.
You mean just ionizing? I mean, you need like 12 eV to even just say anything. So yeah, it's about
EV,
it's less than EV. So I don't know what the temperature they actually put the xenon there. I mean, they've got a cooler, of course. They certainly never talk about this as an issue or as a background. But So let me get to this. So how easy is it to ionize a xenon atom? So the electron is bound in the atom. It has some binding energy, which I'm going to call delta E. And let's ask the question, you know, what's the minimum energy that the dark matter particle has to have in order to overcome this binding energy? That's sort of the minimum thing you need to do. Well, the dark matter energy, again, is given by half mv squared. You want that to be bigger than delta E. There's a limit on the velocity of the dark matter particle in our halo, where we think otherwise the dark matter particle wouldn't be bound anymore. It's of the order of 800 kilometers per second. And if we just put in some numbers, we find that the lowest dark matter particle mass that we need to at least satisfy this is about 3 MeV for a binding energy of 10 eV. Okay? Now, for xenon, there are several. Well, okay, so the first point is, of course, low delta E is good because then you can go to very light dark matter masses. Now, for xenon, there are several outer shells. The outermost ones is a 5p shell, which is a binding energy of about 12 eV. There's also inner more shells, 5s and 4d, which have 26 and 76 eV respectively, but the lowest one is 12 eV. So what you can see is that in principle, you know, if you put in 12 eV here, you really can probe down to a few MeV in dark matter mass. Okay, so as long as you can just ionize this electron. Now let me give you a theorist introduction to the xenon 10 experiment. It consists of a box, and here I'm going to give you a simple detector schematic. Besides the box, inside this box there is some liquid xenon, okay, about 14 kilograms or so. Above this liquid, there is some gas, xenon gas, they put in. And then on top and bottom, there are some photomultiplier tubes where it can detect photons, with which they can detect photons. Then what they do, they put an electric field across this whole volume. The actual electric field is actually different in the gas phase and also in the liquid phase. But anyway, there's an electric field. This electric field allows them to drift electrons. Okay, so if any electrons are being produced inside here, it allows them to drift them. It's a so-called two-phase time projection chamber. So two-phase because it has two phases, obviously, liquid and gas. And time projection chamber means because they've got some timing information, and why, I'll tell you in a second. And it's been operated, it operated for about 1 year in 2006 and 2007, so quite a few years ago. Okay, so that's the basic setup of the Xenon 10 experiment. Now, let me tell you how Xenon 10 detects nuclear recoils. So just imagine ordinary dark matter particles. What do they do to detect those, and how do they distinguish that from backgrounds? Let's begin with that. So here's my detector. There's a signal that's being produced by the photomultiplier tubes as a function of time, which we'll trace through this, throughout this. There is a heavy dark matter particle that's sitting there. Well, not sitting there. It's moving around. It comes in, hits your detector, and produces, let's say it's heavy, and produces, you know, it gives a nice kick to the nuclei, produces lots of photons and electrons. The way this basically produces is that you take the xenon atom, you excite them, they de-excite, you produce photons, or you can ionize them, and then that produces the electrons that you see. Then what happens is that there are basically two types of signals that you're looking for. Okay. First signal is these photons. They, of course, immediately move out, hit the photomultiplier tubes, and are detected by the photomultiplier tubes. This gives you a signal called S1, so prompt scintillation signal. This is just the direct signal that you get from the photons that are released in the interaction. And this is a so-called S1 signal. The electrons take a while. They eventually, because of the electric field, they diffuse up. They move up to the gas phase. Once they enter the gas phase, they bump into the xenon atoms. They produce lots of photons that are being created as they move through the gas phase because there's a strong electric field inside the gas here. And these photons then get detected by the photomultiplier tubes and produce a signal which is called S2, which is basically also a scintillation signal, but it comes from the ionization. And what you notice is that there is a time delay between these signals because the electrons take a while to drift. So this is basically the drift time between these two signals. But in principle, you'll have a nice S1 and a nice S2 signal that gets produced from a dark matter particle hitting the xenon stuff, the xenon liquid in here. Okay. There's also background events, lots and lots of background events from photons, for example, or from electrons and other things. They leave a different kind of signal in the detector. And that's how they're able to distinguish the dark matter particle, in principle, from the background. So electrons or photons from background particles come in. They also produce electrons and photons, but the amount of photons they produce compared to electrons is much less. So this time, you also have an S1 signal, but it's much smaller. And the S2 signal that we find is, again, much larger. Well, this time is much larger than the S1 signal. Again, these electrons that you produce will produce photons, and then they get detected and produce the S2 signal. And if you compare the two, the WIMP signal from the back to the background signal, you notice that the WIMP has a very large S1 over S2 compared to the background, where the S1 over S2 is much smaller. So S2 over S1 for the WIMP is much less than the S2 over S1. And by comparing these signals, S2 and S1, they're able to distinguish the background from the actual signal. Now, we're not interested in WIMPs. We're interested in light dark matter. So what happens then? What about light dark matter? So here, the dark matter particle, now this tiny little thing, comes in, hits an electron, ionizes the atom, and maybe produces one electron that you see there. So this time, there's no S1 signal, or at least nothing that's measurable. The electron again drifts, will produce its photons in the gas, which you detect, and you find a little S2 signal, this time from the electron. So basically what you're looking for the light dark matter is a small S2 signal and nothing for the S1, at least not measurable. And that's the basic signal that you're looking for. Now, xenon 10.
How do you know that there's no scintillation output? Because you know that it's going to be the outer shell, so there's no reorganization of the shells, obviously.
So, I mean, if you just imagine If it's the outer shell, then there shouldn't be anything else,
right?
If it's an inner shell, then you imagine some de-excitation photon, which itself could produce either, well, either photon or this photon could hit other things. That depends a little bit on modeling, and there's you know, models of how liquid xenon behaves. Not measurable. So for these light, for these low energies that we're talking about, it's often not measurable. This is where all the whole uncertainty comes in and effective. You know, for the nuclear recalls, you need like several keV to see anything, to measure anything in S1. And in principle, it does give you some scintillation, or could give you some scintillation, but the question is, will you be able to measure it? Well, a lot of it is also just disappears because it's not the perfect detector. And it might give something, but it might just not trigger on it. And the triggering is actually an issue, because for most of the time, well, as
so
I get...
So you're saying if you have an electron volt gamma, blood tension called gamma, electron volt photon, you won't see that as S1. That's too small.
That's right.
If you can actually show the picture, right? It means that optical photons then, not these energies. UEV is the optical energy as well. Also, I mean, in principle, you have fluorescence. I mean, if you hit the...
I mean, it could give some. Also, if the energy is a bit larger, you might imagine that this electron, you give the electron a big kick, which can do other things, like ionize other things or scintillate other things. So you expect some. The fraction of electrons that you expect is about 0.8, 0.83 or so. But the scintillation light that you get from that is just not something that they trigger on or can observe, apparently. Okay. Yeah?
I just have a dumb question. So, I mean, in the usual dark matter case, there's two one backgrounds. You set your clock with the S1. And the S1 presumably is the S2 because you don't expect. In this case, you just see a single flash.
You see an S2. Yeah, so you have to trigger on it. And they didn't for most of the time because they just cared about WIMPs. But for, okay. So let me, I'll get to that right now. Yeah. So let me just say, sorry. So for each, on average, so each electron that you produce produces about 27 photoelectrons that the photomultiply tubes actually eventually detect, on average. Okay. And this is not that much, but in principle, you can detect it with xenon 10, but the point is that for most of the time that xenon 10 actually ran, they didn't trigger on this. And they only triggered on single electron events, so with no S1, for only 12 and a half days in 2006. So they only have a tiny exposure. And the rest of the time, they required an S1, because of course they were looking for WIMPs. And so most of the time, they didn't have this trigger. But for these 12 and a half days in 2006, they lowered the trigger and just required an S2 signal. And so the final exposure that you have is just 15 kilogram days of that data. Does that answer your question? Or?
More or less. I mean, it really had to do with, is it rare for the background to give you a single flash event?
Okay, let's look at the data.
Sorry?
Let's look at the data, okay. Let me just make a comment before I show the data. So, Peter Sorensen on Xenon 10 used the same data actually to set limits on about 10 GeV dark matter from nuclear recoils. And this, the aim to do that was to constrain the Dharma Kogan region. And that's this limit in green here that you see. Okay, so the same data set was used basically in this analysis now for light dark matter. By light, I now mean sub GeV, but this was used before for 10 GeV dark matter for nuclear recoils.
So this is now the standard Xenon 10 measurement.
That's the standard Xenon 10. So it's the same data set we're using, but we're not using it for nuclear recalls, but instead electron recalls. So let's look at the data. What they see is about 500 events. So they see lots of stuff. Okay. And they see one, two, and there's some evidence for three electron events. So here's the data set. So this is counts as a function of the ionization signal. So what they see is not the actual electrons, right? They see the photoelectrons, the photons that are produced from the electrons. And there's a nice peak for single electrons. There is some two-electron event peak that one can imagine is there. And then maybe there's some evidence for three additional events, but that's not very good.
Sorry, so this has just been rescaled, like this is, one is really, is that the one, the 27 federal electrons?
Yeah. That's right, yeah. So this x-axis has been rescaled to the ionization, to that number of electrons.
Is it pretty linear? Is that interesting?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. So the blue band is just statistical uncertainty. There's some green band here which represents the uncertainty in the trigger efficiency, which I don't want to get into right now. Now, there's a question, of course. They see 500 events. You know, what are these events? What is this background that they're seeing? What are these events that they're seeing? And the answer is that no one really knows. The origin of these events is not clear. There are some possibilities that people are thinking about what it could be. Some of them I can just mention quickly. So there's continuously, you create negatively charged impurities just from other events. You know, photons come in, electrons come in, they hit stuff. You just produce negatively charged impurities. Every now and again, you know, there might be some low-energy photon that dislodges these negatively charged impurities, which then produces single electron events. Maybe it is that. The other thing is that as the electrons come up through the liquid, they hit the liquid-gas interface, and it might be that they just get trapped a while in the middle. And then just randomly they get released. You know, maybe there's some other event going on, but just randomly they get released, and maybe that's causing these single electron events then to appear. There's also a cathode, and maybe this cathode is just spitting out electrons at random times, and you just see those events. But basically, no attempt has been made, really. No serious attempt has been made to understand the origin of these events. It's just not clear what it is.
In the original Xenon 10 paper, they have this plot where they show this accumulation. So you have this accumulation of events at very low recalls, and then there's a gap there where there's essentially nothing, and then a few events show up again. So in the Xenon 10 load measurement, they select a very certain
right
band only, and they have very few events there.
Yeah, I think they require at least five electrons. Four or five, I think five.
Right, but there's an accumulation event at very low recalls.
So those probably the ones.
At least
yeah.
A single electron recalls, and then is it due to this peak structure that there is I seem to remember that there's a gap in between.
Let's look at that, because I'm not, I don't remember the gap, but let's look at that.
Maybe a mistake.
Just so quick, is there an S1 veto on the data?
Yes. Yeah. So there's select events that have no S1. Yeah, I think that's right. I don't know if there was a veto at the trigger. I mean, it was just that they didn't veto it on the trigger. But I think they only, for this analysis they did for the 10 GB dark matter, they only said these are dark matter candidate events if there's no S1. Yeah, but.
Has anybody done a time correlation analysis between waves and past nuclear recall events?
So this was just 12 and a half days. So I mean, what's
so
the aim?
Those 12 and a half days, there were,
take the nuclear events you saw.
Yeah.
And correlate the nuclear events you saw with these events. See whether there's time correlation.
There are events which look like single electron events, which are part of bigger events. So you see like some huge signal, and then a while later you see, you know, you just in that event, in that train record, in that event record which gets read out, they just see single electron events or so. So they see those, but these are events that don't have anything else,
right,
at least in the 160 microsecond, I think it is, that were read out. So that there's quiet and there's just one little
thing. I'm just asking, I mean, you could ask when was the previous other event, and see whether there's a time form, what the distribution of
right. So as far as I know, that has not been done, at least not publicly. Yeah.
Certainly for these explanations that have to do with tension barriers or other.
Right. So good. I mean,
events after a big event.
Yeah.
You would expect some time correlation.
Yeah. So good. So I mean, the basic point is that attempts could be made to understand this. You know, it's not like these are events that you just couldn't try and analyze and see what they are. It's just that the detector now sits, you know, on someone's desk, dismantled, I believe. So one could go back to the data, but one couldn't take additional data, for example, to try and understand it. But there's things that you could do, absolutely. Okay. So from this, you can basically, though, get upper bounds on the rates for single, double, and triple electrons. And here's some numbers. So, well, it doesn't matter what the numbers are. And now what you can do is you can try to set limits on dark matter scattering. One can just assume all these are signal, right, to set a conservative limit. But to do that, we must calculate the dark matter induced ionization rates. And let me just see. Okay, good. And I wanted to spend a few slides on discussing how one actually calculates the ionization rates for dark matter scattering of electrons. Okay. Now, there's lots of things that go into the scattering rate calculation. There is three things that I just want to mention. There is an atomic form factor, right? So there's a wave function that describes the electron inside the atom as it moves around. And you want to sort of know what the probabilities of getting some recoil electron that comes from that comes from bound in some shell. Q here, so this atomic form factor will be noted by F of Q squared. Q is a momentum transfer. Let's discuss this first. So as I said, it's basically the overlap of the wave functions, of the outgoing wave function and the bound wave function. And pictures best to illustrate what it actually is. So we calculate these numerically with some wave functions that people have calculated that were found in the paper for different elements. So we use for xenon in this case. So here's a typical example of what the F of Q squared looks like. I've parameterized this as a function of Q in units of alpha ME. So alpha ME is sort of the typical momentum that you expect in an atom, okay, for an electron to have. And what you find is that this is what it looks like. So it's large. And then once you get to Q of about alpha ME, it starts to drop by a huge amount. And you really can see it drops pretty fast and by a lot. So once Q becomes bigger than alpha ME, which is of order a few keV, so once momentum transfer becomes bigger than alpha ME, the rates really just, there's basically no rates, okay? They're very small rates. Now, what are the typical Q that we're actually talking about here, okay? So where do we actually live in this parameter space here? And I want to show two examples. So in general, there's some formula that relates the minimum dark matter velocity that you need to the binding energy of the electron, to the recoil energy of the outgoing electron, to the momentum transfer and the dark matter mass. Not too important what it is, but you can calculate what the typical Q is for a particular delta E and a particular outgoing recoil energy. And let me give you two examples. One example is for a 10 GeV WIMP particle that hits an electron. And let's pretend we want to try and explain Darmann cogent. You know, maybe Darmann cogent are seeing signals that are from electron recoils. Let's imagine the dark matter is sitting in the electron to get this. What are the Q that you need there? Well, so the recoil energy that you need is about 10 keV. We know what the binding energy is. It's much less than 10 keV. And we can put in some typical numbers, and what you find is that Q is about an MeV. And if you compare that to alpha ME, you find it's a few hundred times alpha ME. And then you can see that out here, the rates, the F of Q squared, the form factor is just going to kill you completely. And basically, for WIMP electron scattering to explain, for example, Darmann cogent, would you really need order a few keV electron recoils? It's totally negligible. Okay. And this was pointed out by people in 2009 already. So it doesn't work. But for us, for sub-GeV dark matter, we're not interested in such high recoils, and we're interested in much lighter dark matter masses. So for us, let's say we just want to take a 10 eV recoiling electron. This gives a Q of a few keV, which is exactly of order alpha ME. And we see that we're still fine. You know, we get some suppression, but not much at these momentum transfers. So for sub-GeV dark matter, you know, this form factor, which one might in principle worry about, is not an important suppression. It's a suppression, but it's not, you know, it doesn't kill you completely. Okay. So that's one thing I wanted to point out. The other thing is just quickly, so the scattering rate, instead of, in addition to depending on the atomic form factor, it also depends on the dark matter form factor, okay? That depends on your model. I'll show you results for two different models where the dark matter form factor is 1 and the dark matter form factor is 1 over Q squared. If there's time, I'll show you how those come about. But basically, well, for the 1 over Q squared, you of course prefer lighter momentum transfers. And depending on your element, this is easier to detect than this. But anyway, one can just see the sensitivity of the results to the different form factors. And then we also parameterize the scattering rate with a free, with a cross-section scatter of a free electron, and we put bounds on the sigma e. Okay, so this is the thing we put bounds on, and everything else depends on the model or the atomic form factor which is calculated. Okay, now one more point I want to make, I already sort of alluded to it earlier, is that in addition to just having single electron events, we can also get events with two electrons or three electrons. Okay, and the reason is, of course, well, it's sort of very simple, but this outgoing electron, if it has a lot of energies, a lot of energy, so after the dark matter hits an electron, the electron recoils, has a lot of energy. This can, of course, ionize other electrons, which could cause two or three electron events. And also, the thing that Itai alluded to is that if you ionize an inner shell electron, then you've got a de-excitation photon, which itself can go out and ionize other electrons. So we try to model that in some way. But in principle, it's good to look for these two and three electron events also, because depending on your, background rates, you might get stronger constraints on the two, using the two and three electron events than just the pure single electron events. Okay. So let me show you some of the results. So here are results. Let me walk you through this plot. Okay. Let's see. So on the vertical axis, on the vertical axis, we've got sigma e, so that's the cross section to scatter of a free electron. As I mentioned, we parameterize everything of that now. So you can always compare these plots to the scattering of the nucleons. So now we've got a sigma e instead of a sigma nucleon. On the horizontal axis, we've got dark matter masses, and notice now that it's the MeV scale, not GeV. So we're going from one MeV up to 1,000 MeV, so one GeV. So it's three orders of magnitude less than the typical plots that you would see, which otherwise look similar. This plot is for momentum independent action, which I'll explain in a second. There's constraints from various from single, double, and triple electron events. And there's some, these are the different constraints, and they're constrained differently. The strongest constraint you get at high dark matter masses from three electron events, which makes sense, because if you've got a heavy dark matter particle that hits an electron, there's a lot of energy that's transferred, and which could, in principle, ionize lots of other electrons. The black line here is the combined limit that you get. There's some uncertainty, systematic uncertainties, which are shown by gray and gray bands. And as I already mentioned, so the strongest constraint is at high masses from three electron events.
How does this plot look like for form factor
monomer CRISPR? I'll show you in a second. So first, there is this green region that, I don't know if you can see this. It's much better on my screen.
Turn on the monitor.
Say again?
There's a monitor showing the same.
Oh, thank you. Okay, so look at this one. So there's this green region here that you see. And the question is, what is this green region? So the green region is just some model, which is sort of a nice model. Let me explain quickly what it is. So imagine that, just take some simple model where the dark matter is charged in some hidden U1. Which mixes with hypercharge through kinetic mixing, so just a standard hypercharge. Lagrangian level, you can write down some mixing between hypercharge and this hidden U1 through some mixing parameter epsilon. You can calculate the way then the dark matter interacts with electrons is through this scattering of this force mediator of the hidden U1, this heavy photon, this which I'm going to call A prime here. So dark matter comes in and through this interaction can interact and scatter of electrons, and then you can get the recoil of the electron.
It's called the Holden boson.
It's called the Holden boson, fine.
This is
Canada. Absolutely, yeah. I said too many people to cite, but I think really should have cited that, absolutely. Okay. I should have had a picture. Okay. Anyway, so what you get, you can calculate what the cross-section is. It depends on lots of factors. The important factor that I want to focus on, so it depends on the masses of the electron, on the fine structure constant, on the hidden sector, gauge coupling, this hidden U1, epsilon, this mixing parameter here, on the dark matter mass, on the A prime mass, and also on the momentum transfer squared. And if we just recall what typical momentum transfer we have, it's of order alpha ME, so that's a few kV. So if we take A prime masses to be much larger than a few kV, so if we take them, for example, to be an MeV or 10 MeV or so, then the Q squared dependence really is not important, and we just get sort of a constant cross section, constant as a function of Q squared. And that gives us a form factor that's just one. Okay, so it doesn't have any momentum dependence. Yeah. Okay. The green region then is basically the region that we get using the simple model where the dark matter self-interaction cross section is consistent with all observations, right? So dark matter has some self-interaction through the Z prime. We choose an MA prime mass bigger than MEV that's consistent with all constraints that people have currently thought about. And then also, as an aside, and as I already mentioned before, we would be totally screwed by CMB constraints if the dark matter particle could just annihilate with thermal cross sections. So we can just imagine that it's produced, that it's asymmetric dark matter. Okay. But given all that, you get this green region. And what you see is that, well, let's look at this one again. There's lots of parameter space that's open, but already you're probing relevant parameter space with a simple and small data set. Okay. 1/q², so it's I asked about it. So here's what it would look like with 1/q² interactions. Let's look at this one again. So we have got constraints from single, double, and triple electron events, these different lines here. So here the single electron events dominate because you're biasing yourself towards low momentum transfer. So you prefer to just to produce give as little momentum as possible to the electron so it can't produce lots of secondary events. Again, there's some blue region that I'm showing here, which is some model. It's actually the same model. Let me get to it in a second. And already we're probing relevant parameter space of this model. So what is the blue region? It's the same model as before, okay? Again, with a hidden photon. But now we're choosing A prime masses to be very small, so less than EV. And this time, this term in the denominator is negligible compared to the Q squared. And we get a form factor that's 1/q² dependent. Okay. So sort of the same model, just in different regions of parameter space, can give you the different behavior. And again, the blue region is consistent with all constraints from self-interactions, constraints on A prime, et cetera. And maybe I'll skip this. There's sort of an interesting theory region, which I'll skip. OK. So for xenon 10, just to summarize, it accidentally already sets meaningful limits on dark matter electron recoils. But again, it's only a measly 15 kilogram days, And it was designed to study nuclear recoils. It wasn't designed to do this. And the question is, how well can we actually do an experiment with an experiment that does this on purpose, that really looks for this a dedicated way? So maybe if you say some future projections, let's look at this one again. So here's some future projections for a kilogram year for various elements. So here's the same green region that we had before. The xenon 10 limit is shown up here. This is a kilogram year. So instead of 15 kilogram days, it's much more, much larger exposure. And this is what we, that's what we think we can probe. One interesting thing that you see here is this germanium line, all right, which really goes to very light dark matter masses. And this is one thing that I want to emphasize. So all these other elements here are noble gases, so helium, xenon, argon. They've got ionization energies that of at least 12 eV for xenon and similar order of magnitude for helium and argon. But germanium, a semiconductor, so it has a, you can really reach much lower masses in principle with that. It has a band gap that's only about an EV, so it's much lower than the xenon thing, which is 12 EV. This band gap, so all you need to do is you need to excite the electron you need to excite the electron to the conduction band, and that's just an EV energy that you need. And there's, of course, lots of semiconductors that are around. So CDMS uses germanium and silicon. Their threshold is very high. It's about 300 electrons, okay? So nowhere near what we want. There's something called CDMS light, which basically is CDMS, but you just ramp up the voltage. And you produce lots of phonons that come if you have an electron. And the threshold, my understanding, is about a few electrons. It's not quite there where we want it, but it's interesting way to go. There's also this DAMIC thing that I mentioned earlier already, which sets the best limit for nuclear recoils at light masses. They have a current threshold of about 40 EV, and they hope that in the future they get to about 4 EV. So there's really a lot of exciting potential. And these semiconductors might be the way to go if you can control, of course, control the backgrounds. But at least in principle, you can probe to really light, very light dark matter masses with those. And
for your solid bands, what are you assuming as far as the backgrounds?
Yes. Yeah, so this plot ignores backgrounds, so it's like, you know, the elephant in the room.
Oh, okay.
So I assume no backgrounds.
Zero backgrounds,
yeah. It doesn't actually, well, you know, even if you assume, you know, 10 background events, 100, it doesn't scale massively. I mean, this, of course, weakens it. But this whole, you know, this whole program or whatever, it's not going to work if we can't control the backgrounds or at least understand them. There's many backgrounds that we, in principle, know about. Some of them are just not important, like neutrinos. So the time that neutrinos will become important, you know, we will have covered lots of parameter space. There's other things, radioactive impurities, surface events, secondary events, lots of stuff we haven't thought about. This stuff requires serious thought, but to my mind, there's no obvious background that's just going to totally, you know, kill you right from the beginning. It's something where we have to learn about. We have to learn what the backgrounds are and deal with them as we're doing experiments. And as I said, there's no obvious no-go theorem here. You know, there doesn't seem to be some insurmountable background that we have to deal with.
I mean, in Xenon there was, right?
No, but there's been no attempt to understand it, right? So
sure.
That's what I mean. There's backgrounds, but I'm saying that there's no reason why one couldn't try to understand them, right? And there's been no attempt, right? And yeah, and I don't know, you know, once people actually, well, once experimenters actually start thinking about it, it's potential. That's true. Yeah, it might be.
Or there might not.
Right.
But
I don't know. I'm just saying right now there's no obvious one that I know about. And it's a matter of having people really think about it. And then there's always something that you can always use to distinguish the signal from the background. In principle, is the angular modulation of the dark matter. For light dark matter, it's actually much larger than for WIMP dark matter. It's about 10%. Okay. Now, of course, this always worries people, angular modulation. Dharma has been around for ages. That sees an angular modulation, which was supposed to be this convincing signal for dark matter. Well, I don't know how many people in the room are convinced. I doubt that anyone is. So that's something you worry about. But I think it can be done much better than it's being done right now. And with experiments both in Northern Hemisphere and Southern Hemisphere, one could try to really figure out. It's still a powerful signal for dark matter. Okay. So let me get to the conclusions. The direct detection of sub-GB dark matter is possible. You know, there's existing technologies that can detect the signals that one would see. Lots of work has to be done to understand backgrounds, of course. I showed you the first limits on dark matter down to a few MeV masses. And there's lots of theoretical work that's required to, you know, explore models of sub-GB dark matter and also think about, explore some of these other detection methods that I mentioned. And then, of course, we need an experimentalist to actually want to build a dedicated experiment. But I hope then that, you know, this region of parameter space can sort of be opened up by doing these experiments. Thank you.
Any other questions? Does your cartoon of Xenon 10 also work for Xenon 100? And is there also a 15-day window that they looked at?
So they haven't. So my understanding is that they try to lower the thresholds, and they're seeing lots of events, lots of background events, and they
signal.
Yeah. I don't know if this is really worse than some of the other signals we were talking about. I'm kidding.
Exactly.
Right.
Is that really crypto or is that independent?
I don't know. I don't know if they know. I don't think they know what it is. But it's my understanding was that they lowered the threshold and they're just seeing lots of crap.
If you take the
2 kilogram
days and you try to calculate the signal, what parameters would you come up with?
So, I mean, you can sort of see from the plots the rough. It's basically where you're starting to exclude stuff. I mean, it'll be around here, right?
Okay, so you assume that all
of
the events are...
We assume all of them are signal, yeah. So it's, yeah. I mean, it's just that no attempt has been made to understand them, and I think that there's many things we can do to try to understand them and really characterize them. Oh, yeah, no, absolutely, yeah. Yeah, right. Right, one wonders.
Yeah.
Ittai is very excited about that.
Hallelujah. All right, so we had all the questions already, so I think.